When I was cooking, some chefs made great efforts to make as much from scratch as possible, which meant we made as much from scratch as possible. Ketchup and mayonnaise and mustard were consistent every single time we bought them, so we didn't make those, and I don't make my own ketchup. I do make some of the staples, partly for control of the ingredients and partly for the cost, and partly to keep the old skills alive. Now, there's a whole niche about homesteading and the old ways, and this is not that show. Do you replace commercial with homemade? Would you do it if you could and it was easy? The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 261, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the show. I've been making more of my own foodstuffs, which means more than zero. I think there are a few reasons for that, which I mentioned, and one of them really seriously is cost, especially now. Part of why I make my own stuff also is quality control, and part of that seems like that's the right thing to do. I tried making my own mayonnaise, but without an immersion blender, the rest of the household doesn't care too much for the mouthfeel. I get it. It's very difficult to meet and then beat the consistency of best foods, or as you East Coast folks call it, Hellman's. I want to make my own mayo to get out of seed oil any way that I possibly can, and getting rid of mayonnaise is one good way to start doing that. If you read labels, seed oils seem to be everywhere. It's kind of like sugar. And I saw canola oil in my dog's food, for crying out loud. I also make my own peanut butter. Now, I don't have to compete with Jif or Skippy, since those are homogenized. I'm competing with those so-called natural peanut butters. Unless you use the peanut butter machine at your supermarket, which is pretty snazzy, and I have, you are getting something more, sometimes more than just peanuts and salt, in those other, scare quotes, natural peanut butters. They're not all terrible, but you got to read labels. I do like the satisfaction that comes from pureeing peanuts into peanut butter. Instant happiness, and I only had to get the peanuts from the pantry. I am working, well, I'm not doing anything. The pickles are doing something. I am working on a batch of lacto-fermented pickles. I had a minor bumper crop of cucumbers, and the whole idea of lacto-fermentation has been on my mind for a while, so the opportunity existed. Now, lacto-fermentation so far has been an interesting experience, and it's not done being interesting. It's also not done fermenting. I like the idea of probiotic food made at home. I did make a batch of kimchi, well, I lost track of time, some months ago, and I'm keen to try it again. I think one of the important things in my neck of the woods is doing it in the garage when it's not 115 degrees in the middle of the day. I think that makes a big difference. So all those homemade things, and then there's cheese. Well, fresh cheese is pretty easy. Mozzarella takes some attention and some tolerance for your hands in nearly boiling water. Farmer's cheese, which is milk coagulated with an acid, usually vinegar, stirred for a few minutes, left to sit off the burner for a few more minutes, then strain the curds into a cheesecloth and tie it up and hang it. Now, that's a lot of steps, but none of them are really too difficult. I decided some weeks ago I wanted to make my own cream cheese. At the current price, it is getting close to almost as cheap to make at home as it is to buy. But not really, and I'll get into that. There's the immediate cost of replacing the store version, which might be less if you shop the sales and get milk on a deal, or get milk and cream or half and half on a deal. And sometimes, you know, you can do that. Making homemade mayo and peanut butter is almost a one-for-one activity. That means you get out almost entirely everything you put in, with a little bit of waste stuck to the side of the mixing utensil or the bowl. And so that's fine. That's an expected and accepted loss. Cheese, on the other hand, has a low return for product for ingredient, and there is the expected remainder of the whey. For every gallon of milk used to make farmer's cheese, expect 4 cups of cheese and 12 cups of whey. Now, that alone is already a good explanation of why cheese becomes expensive. Add in the fromagier's time, and that's probably the wrong word for the guy, or the person of the craft who's tending to the cheese in the cave, washing it with briny liquid and turning it and watching it age. And there's a lot of labor that goes into cheese, so there's a fair reason that it costs a lot, but that's also another show, which might just happen. So, 16 cups of milk gives you 4 cups of cheese. It's not a lot, especially if you're doing only a quart. You get a cup. Now, the whey, the leftover stuff. Remember your nursery rhymes eating her curds and whey. Well, the whey is the leftover liquid, which isn't just water. It's got protein and other stuff in it, including the acid you used to coagulate the milk. So that whey can be used quite nicely as a liquid in homemade bread. It actually makes fantastic bread. The whey can also be used to make ricotta. Now, I have a personal beef with websites that call farmer's cheese ricotta, since the word ricotta, ricotta, means twice cooked. Whey is used to make traditional ricotta, a designation from the ersatz to modern ricotta found on, that designation is found on Google. You type in ricotta cheese, you're going to get farmer's cheese. You have to type in traditional ricotta to find out what that process is used for of whey, and you still get leftover stuff. Ricotta was not my goal. Cream cheese, as stated, was my goal. And it was to that same search engine I went for some recipes for cream cheese. Nearly all the recipes in the search I performed several times were basically the same. Some amount of dairy. Some recipes were only whole milk. Some were whole milk and cream. Some were whole milk and half and/or cream. You get the idea. Salt and acid, either lemon juice or vinegar, heat and clean tools, and you're in business. Now, even procedure varies from some to some. Some say boil, some say don't boil. The down and dirty version is heat your amount of dairy to probably at least 180 degrees. I'm sure you'll find one that reads less. Add the coagulant a tablespoon at a time. Watch it curdle, which it's supposed to do, on the heat. Take it off the heat for a few minutes. Strain that curd into cheesecloth and over a strainer. I would save the whey, but then drain your package. Tie it up and drain it, and there's your cheese curds. I did the whole milk and half and cream. So I did 2 cups of milk, a cup of half and half, and a cup of cream. I chose rice wine vinegar as the coagulant. I've made cheese before, both with an acid coagulant and with rennet, and I know the curdled part, the curds that float, can vary in appearance and in some, well, they all look white, but they can vary in size. They can get kind of big. The curds here were small. I mean, surprisingly, it's like this very, very surprised how tiny these little curds were of clumped coagulated protein. That was unexpected and, to me, kind of interesting. So the curds were so small that I had to use a kitchen tea towel as the straining cloth, since the holes in the cheesecloth were just too large. And I'm pretty sure some portion, more than I wanted, would have gone through the cheesecloth into the whey, and I didn't want that. So I strained it through the cheesecloth, drained it for about an hour, and got some fair amount of whey to continue dripping out of it. I did at that point, because now it was relatively solid, transfer it to the same cheesecloth I didn't use, now I do use, because the wider holes allowed for more whey to come out, which is exactly what happened. The whole goal here for this cream cheese was to use it as the base for a cheese ball for a dinner we were going to. So I strained it and drained it for about an hour. I was still a bit damp. I used damp instead of using the M word. You know who you are. But for the final use of that cheese ball, a little damp was okay. And many of the recipes on the Google for cream cheese had the procedure to place the drained curd into a food processor and process until smooth to replicate that nice grain-free cream cheese. It's cream cheese. It's also creamy cheese, to replicate that consistency. And some recipes did read to add heavy cream to that puree, because what ended up happening, even though it was still damp, it seized up a little bit in the food processing part. So adding some cream will loosen that up a little bit. So I did that. And the people who ate it at the party were very complimentary. It was a big hit. I was pretty tickled with how it came out. So score one for the good guys. A digital friend on Facebook who commented on the post that I made about making this cream cheese said that he uses sour cream and half and half and let those two ingredients incubate for some time. Now, if he said how long, I don't recall, but the process he described seems like the same way we used to make creme fraiche. So I tried it with a half a cup of each. And I let it incubate in the bread proofer for about 18 hours. I set it to 90 degrees, and it never did get solid. Now, creme fraiche would turn solid, and there were a few variables here. One is, I think the creme fraiche we made was with buttermilk and cream, not sour cream and cream. It might have been a little warmer. We put it in that particular restaurant. There was a closet that had the hot water heater, and so because the door was closed, it was pretty nice and toasty warm in there, and it may have been hotter than 90 degrees. It's been a long time, I don't recall. But anyway, it did set up a little bit, but pretty good actually. So I put it in the refrigerator, and it seized up a little bit more, which is what I wanted to have happen. So I took that, drained it in a coffee filter lined strainer, and got about a quarter of a cup of whey out of that, which was surprisingly little. Now, what remained didn't have the cream cheese texture or taste that I expected. It seemed like rich sour cream, which is fine. The process, incubating cultured sour cream in a medium, is the same way yogurt is made. You just switch out and plain yogurt to your, you could probably yogurt heavy cream. Wow, wouldn't that be a thing? Yogurt heavy cream. But so a yogurt culture in milk will produce yogurt when you incubate it for, if you have a little yogurt maker, it's about 6 ounce little cups. The directions read about 8 hours. But it's pretty easy to do when I've done yogurt before. Now, I had the idea, which remains only that, I've not acted on it, to heat the rich sour cream to somewhere around the 160 degree area, add some acid to it, and see what comes. I might not actually do that, but I wondered, I just was wondering about it. Now, rich sour cream or pretty decent cream cheese would be a really good place for this experiment to end. I chose the sour cream version in part due to the ingredients on the cream cheese box, which read milk, cream, and lactic acid bacteria. Well, okay, it sounds like sour cream. Turns out yes, but no, not really. Lactic acid bacteria is a thing you can buy. It is in proper buttermilk and proper sour cream, but I'm not sure, and I sort of doubt, it's present in substantial quantities, maybe in zero quantities, in pasteurized products. And as I wrote that, I did a quick Google search, and that indicated that pasteurization does kill lactic acid bacteria. It doesn't kill the effect, but it kills that bacteria. So, a better search reveals that those lemon juice cream cheese recipes are ersatz cream cheese recipes, just like those ricotta recipes are ersatz ricotta recipes. It's a fast approximation that has nothing to do with the real thing. Now, it is moments just like this, the right way and the home cook way, where my Harvey Dent duality comes out. On the one side is do it right. Do it right. On the other side is do it as close as you can with the tools and the space you have. Chef versus home cook. To make cream cheese like the stuff in the store requires more. More stuff, maybe a little bit more space, but mostly you need proper lactic acid bacteria as a starter. You don't get that at your local Mega Mart. Probably stainless steel cooking vessels and a fair amount of cheesecloth to hold all this stuff. You also need cream. You could use milk and cream, but you need to have cream. What remains uncertain to me is if the pasteurized milk of today differs in any substantial way from the pasteurized milk of 100 years ago. Or maybe the milk differs from 100 years ago. That certainly is a possibility, but I have no way of verifying that. That certainly does seem a worthwhile rabbit hole to pursue. It's a question. I don't know. So, is ersatz cream cheese worth making? I think so. Several of the recipes also indicate to process the cheese, drained curds in the food processor, which I mentioned that I did. I would do this again now that I have a better idea what's going on. So I use for that quart of dairy, I use 3 tablespoons of rice wine vinegar. Now it's entirely possible that rice wine vinegar, even though it's an acid, is not nearly as acidic as lemon juice. So the first thing to try is do the same thing, 2-1-1 and 3 tablespoons of fresh lemon juice, and see if I get a different curd result. So one thing I mentioned earlier as a cost isn't really the thing, but it is a byproduct of cheese making is you get the whey and you use that in making breads. But if you make a lot of cheese, how much bread can you really make? And you're spending all day in the kitchen, which isn't altogether bad, but other things have to happen. Life goes on. So gluten-free recipes. If you're the kind of person that can stand to drink it, just that's probably okay. But the other thing, it's a good additive in the dog's kibble. So I did that for my dog. My dogs get all kinds of fun and interesting things added to their food, and they didn't complain one little bit. So another good way to give them a little bit of extra protein. So the question I asked, is it worth making? The answer is yes. It's worth doing at least once. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I have this addendum to make about homemade foods. they are not equal to the thing they replace. GIF is damn smooth, and that has a huge appeal, especially if you're the first one opening the jar. That's awesome. Just, I don't know why it's so much fun to be the first guy to swipe the top, but it is. Commercial mayo or sugary commercial yogurt and gummy cream cheese have become the standard. And the replacements, no matter how good, will require multiple exposures to at least be tolerated. But if the goal is to eliminate seed oils and gums from your diet, which is a worthy goal, then it's worth pursuing for better health. Recently, I mentioned an app called Chronometer, which is a good tool to measure your macronutrients. That's your fat, protein, and carbs. It also measures some micronutrients, which I like. It also measures some vitamins. I have an affiliate link for this app. In addition to measuring macros and some micros, it also measures calories. They call it energy. Now, we all know, or most of us know, those who are telling us such things, that 2,000 calories is the suggested intake. Well, I struggle many days to get even up to 1,800 calories, and I eat a lot of fat. So it's a good way to, it's interesting to watch what happens when I'm eating. So there is an upgrade version, which includes more measurements, but the free version is good, and that's the one that I use. Chronometer has a pretty vast database of commercial foods, including some Trader Joe's products and every commercial thing you could probably think of in the store. You can also enter your own recipes and learn what calories, proteins, fats, and carbs you're getting from Granny's lasagna. So I find it useful to sort of get a visual look of, are you getting enough protein? And you'd be surprised to find out the answer is probably no. You can visit culinarylibertarian.com/eatright to find out more about Chronometer. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.